have been found and is now in the possession of the Army.
Okay, we'll assume it's friendly anyway, okay?
There's two of them, and they
stayed
directly
in
spot the whole time.
They're
outside, like, say that.
Oh, my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh, Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please. All right, Lisa, are you ready for this?
The cameraman said, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular hit. UFOs over New York,
and I am too surprised.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that these days like these.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
Strange days indeed. Most peculiar, Mama.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Welcome to edition 460 of Strange Days Indeed, the program that covers the news, the politics, the personalities, and the cases of UFOs. This time, a fairly intense look at what Frank Fascino is calling the biggest unknown UFO flap in UFO history, which happened in September 1952. With Frank Fascino, Dave Frelott, and Alfred Lemberg. We'll also hear from documentary maker David Cherniak and talk about his long-awaited UFOs, The Secret History, also known as UFOs and the Politics of Reality, which debuts on the Canadian History Channel on July 15th. So, to get things rolling, as usual,
these are Strange Days Indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Frelott.
There's an old adage spoken by parents to their children that goes, don't do as I do as I say. It's generally used to cover up when parents have made a mistake and don't want to admit their error to their children. In this particular instance, two very eminent ufologists, Richard Hall and Jerome Clark, are guilty of doing something that they have accused debunkers of doing. They are refusing to examine facts and evidence that contradict their opinion because their minds are already made up. Frank Fascino Jr. has done considerable research into UFO sightings and reports, particularly when it comes to encounters that involved pursuit by military aircraft of the United States. His efforts of some 17 years have been well documented in a book that he has had published entitled Shoot Them Down, and some of his facts simply boggle the mind. In Shoot Them Down, he focuses particularly on what can only be called an aerial battle that occurred in the airspace of the United States back in the fall of 1952, and sightings of UFOs actually peaked sometime around September of 1952. Frank spent a lot of time tracking down all of that information from witnesses, Project Blue Book reports, and newspaper archives. Frank has gathered data that shows that on September 12th of 1952, there were 12 UFOs that actually crash-landed on U.S. soil, with no fewer than 10 of those 12 happening in West Virginia. Now, the alarming thing that I find in all of this is that the U.S. military's position officially became one of shooting down UFOs back in the 1950s. And this information was published in newspapers across the United States, which, in hindsight, is an interesting position adopted by an organization that eventually determined UFOs pose no threat to national security. What is also interesting is the large number of military aircraft that are officially listed as being accidents that happened when the U.S. military began trying to intercept UFOs. As a matter of fact, there have been numbers mentioned in a thread on the UFO updates list stating 1,000 aircraft lost. And Frank actually states that in June and July of 52, there were 235 aircraft lost. Now, I found those numbers staggering. And when I checked out some public statistics, it appears that I have more than enough reason to be staggered. You see, I decided to find out what U.S. Air Force and U.S. Naval aircraft losses were suffered in the Vietnam War. Between the 8th of March 1964 and the 28th of September 1972, the following aircraft were lost in combat losses over North Vietnam. United States Air Force, F-105s, 282, F-4s, 192, F-100s, 16, F-102s, 1, F-104s, 4, F-111s, 6, RF-101s, 27, RF-4s, 37, B-52s, 17, C-130s, 2, EB-66, 4, B-57s, 5, RC-47s, 1, A-1s, 18, T-28s, 1, and 01s and 02s, 5. The United States Navy, A-4s, 173, A-6s, 52, F-4s, 73, A-7s, 38, RF-4s, 1, F and RF-8s, 18, A-3s, 1, RA-5s, 21, and A-1s, 43. That gives a grand total of 1,038 aircraft lost, which is rather incredible when you consider that was four whole years of serious war compared to trying to intercept some UFOs. So can you understand why I'm staggered at the numbers being bandied around as being lost in pursuit of UFOs? When you start talking losses of 235 aircraft over 2 months, or more than 1,000 that have been lost overall, that says to me that the U.S. has been waging a serious aerial war against something that poses no threat to national security. However, it does make a little sense now as to why the official military position is that UFOs don't exist. And if they did exist, they pose no threat to us. See, if you admit they exist, you also have to admit that you have been getting your butt kicked 12 ways from Sunday every time you try and tangle with them. And here's the kicker. Frank has documented evidence in his possession to verify the numbers that he's talking about. These are not just numbers he pulled out of a hat. But some people refuse to accept or even look at the evidence that Frank has in his possession. Frank Fascino has been belittled by Richard Hall and Jerome Clark because there was some erroneous data published in the Flatwoods Monster book. And although Frank explained how that happened, Richard and Jerome paid no attention to it because their minds were already made up. Incidentally, another eminent ufologist, Stanton Friedman, has visited with Frank Fascino. He's seen firsthand much of what Frank has collected over the years. And Stan has never been one to throw his support behind somebody on a simple whim. And his support is definitely behind Frank. And by the way, Frank's collection is so large, right now he's working on a deal on getting a ufology museum opened just from what he has gathered from the last 17 years. Now, all in all, though, I'm somewhat shocked in many ways. And not the least of which is how Richard Hall and Jerome Clark have decided that they should not be bothered with any facts because their minds have already been made up. I honestly don't believe that Frank Fascino Jr. has written a book that is fiction. And that belief is based on the incredible amount of evidence he is freely willing to share with anyone that wants to take a look at it. To put it bluntly, I think the first two people that should examine some of that evidence should be Richard Hall and Jerome Clark. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange Days, indeed.
And as always, Dave Furlong, a splendid take. And very much to the point.
I still can't believe the guy is basically doing that. I don't believe in what you're saying there because I happen to know about this particular thing. Well, maybe it was wrong.
Yes, it was wrong. And It wasn't Frank's fault because, as Alfred Lemberg explained to the UFO updates list, the publisher butchered the book, chopping it from 800 and something pages down to about 300.
Yeah, exactly. And that is a butcher job.
Very much so.
Being a writer myself, I've had to bring stuff down. I've had to edit it down to a small size. And by the time you're done, you've just chopped away so much that basically you have a completely different piece. And in that situation, that's exactly what they've done. You're talking facts that are just gone and left with facts that have no correlation to anything else.
Here's one story, and here's another story, and I'll just pull out the end of one and the start of the other and butt them together.
Let's not forget one little thing, too, because I believe it was Richard that was talking in terms of publishing. Publishers won't do all of that. Publishers have one little thing that they want to do, and it's called sell books and make money. And if that means that they have to change this phrase or this word or this paragraph in their viewpoint in order to sell books and make money, change. It's a done deal.
And if the publisher is honest, he'll give the author the opportunity to make the changes himself. And Frank had done changes and submitted them, and then somebody else had gone through and sliced and diced his book.
Oh, yeah.
And he didn't get to see the galley proofs.
The thing is, too, and I'm even going to say this with my own publisher. They've sent out something, you make the corrections, you send it back to them, and for some reason the corrections get missed and goes into print without the corrections. So don't try and tell some of us who have actually published stuff that publishers don't do this, because they do.
And more often than not,
it's whatever is in their best interest. Not necessarily in the best interest of the author, whatever is in their best interest. That's why authors need agents in a lot of situations.
And it's not just publishers who do that. Look what's been happening over in the United Kingdom with the Sun newspaper and the supposed chase by a UFO of a Welsh police helicopter.
Yes.
The tabloids do it too.
As long as you put them into their proper category, you have to realize that you're not dealing with news per se as much as sensationalism.
That's what sells their papers.
That's right. They can get a headline that you look at and you go, wow, that's crazy. I got to read about this. You're going to buy it.
Of course. I really hope that Jerry Clark and Dick Hall hear this.
Yes.
And then read Shoot 'Em Down, and the next book that Frank is coming out with, which we will be discussing a little later in this edition of SDI.
I think that's all that really needs to be done. Just take a look at it. Review some of the facts. Think about it. Give it a chance. And if you review the facts, if you review the evidence, and you still have that opinion, you can substantiate it, then fine. But at least take a look at the evidence. Don't just turn around and say, I don't believe this. This is absolute trash or absolute garbage. Just because you happen not to like the guy or because of a mistake that he's not even responsible for.
Yeah.
It boggles me how much stuff Frank has gathered.
It's absolutely mind-blowing the amount, as you'll hear in the interview I have coming up with him.
It's nuts how much stuff he has got together.
Yeah.
And a lot of the stuff that he has is public information. A lot of stuff that's in newspapers. And let's face facts. Most of the newspaper reporters will actually confirm information. They're not just going to put stuff out there.
They certainly used to back in those days.
Oh, yeah, big time. They had to work on the old adage of two or three people to substantiate something before they could actually print it, because otherwise their editors would have had their heads.
As has happened to even people who work at the New York Times of late.
Exactly.
By the way, are you going to David Cherniak's screening of his documentary in the Royal Movie Theater here in Toronto?
I just may be there. Should be an excellent, excellent screening.
David Cherniak and I are going to talk about that in just a few moments. Talk to you next time, Dave.
For sure.
For sure. Bye, Dave.
Bye-bye.
Those of you who have been listening to this program for the last 4 or 5 years will recognize the name David Cherniak. Back in 2004, he decided to make a history of UFOs. And to that end, he set out in 2005 in a recreational vehicle, an RV, a honking big camper with a satellite dish on top for communications. He set off south of the border and across Canada to interview many, many people who've been involved in the UFO field for many, many years. And the result of 4 years of incredibly hard work is a stunning documentary which various contributors to this program in the last couple of months or so have discussed. That documentary, a 2-hour feature documentary, UFOs, The Secret History, which David originally called UFOs and the Politics of Reality, will receive its world television broadcast premiere here in Canada on the History Channel on July the 15th at 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, and will repeat at midnight. But there will be a public preview screening on July the 8th at 7 p.m. for those of you who are subscribers to this program and who live in the Toronto area, and I know there are a few of you out there. The screening at the Royal Cinema, 608 College Street West here in Toronto. And if you want to book in advance, you can call 416-534-5252. There, that's some of the housekeeping out of the way. Let me introduce you, if you haven't heard him before, to multi-award-winning documentarian David Cherniak. David, welcome back to the program.
I'm touched.
So you damn well should be.
So I damn well am. Tears of gratitude streaming down my face.
Yeah, for all 27 people who are hearing this and who can get to the screening.
By the way, they shouldn't call the box office. They should rather email me if they want to reserve tickets. I'm just going to hand the box office a list of names and numbers of people to walk up, because I don't think the box office is open that often. It opens at around 5 or so, or even later, 6:30, they told me, actually, before the screening. So don't bother to call the box office. Email me at davidc@allinonefilms.com. That's allinonefilms spelled out .com. And I'll put tickets aside.
davidc@allinonefilms.com. Antiquated hours at the Royal, but technology is wonderful there, huh?
Yes, the technology is great. The Theatre D folks in Toronto have taken over this old theatre and essentially converted it into a superb high-definition screening facility. So I'm really looking forward to it. It's not that often you get to look at your work, especially if you're working for television, on a large screen in front of a large audience.
In high definition, too.
With the latest projector.
David has quite an astounding basement with all of the technology necessary to produce documentaries there in high def. And you do all of your own stuff. You shoot, you edit, you write, you narrate, sound mixes. You put the whole package together in your basement.
First of all, we don't call it the basement. We call it the studio.
My apologies.
It's quite all right. It's good. My wife should be on hearing range. She would be extraordinarily upset with you, Errol. Yes, I have set up that facility. I have a bent for doing electronic stuff. So consequently, it's all homemade, everything from the computers to the wiring to the patching board, everything. It's a good thing I was out of work for a couple of months, I think 5 or 6 years ago, so I could throw this together.
I have to say again, David, that having seen your doc twice now, it's absolutely perfect in every way, as far as I'm concerned, and doubtlessly there will be people who look at it and go,
well, I'm sure some people will. For the most part, either the true believers and the true disbelievers, the debunkers who I have a little bit of gentle fun at their expense, wouldn't you say?
Yes.
There's one firefly that'll probably go down in history, in the annals of debunking lore. I'm coming out at the end and saying what I personally believe, but I'm not trying to convince anybody, unlike virtually every documentary that I've seen, with one or two exceptions that were done for major television networks. Like most documentaries that I consider pulp documentaries, even some that are fairly well known and promoted these days, they basically are trying to convince people that UFOs are real and they're here and they're probably extraterrestrial. I'm not trying to do that. I'm trying to show that because there is no definitive proof, word definitive is the operative word, there is no definitive proof that's going to convince everybody. Let's just take the extraterrestrial hypothesis that we are being visited. Then the phenomenon has become like a societal Rorschach inkblot. It's become, in the words of the script, an amorphous shape on which we've projected the hopes and fears of the last six decades. And the film traces how that mythological projection has changed and reflected its own era, how it's moved from the 50s into the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, and even the 90s, and perhaps even this decade, how it really tends to reflect what's going on in the culture in many, many ways, and the culture reflects back to it. It's a very interesting phenomenon, though I suppose is common to all mythology. By using that word, I'm not saying that there's nothing there. What I'm saying is that there is a mythology that has grown up around an actual phenomenon, and that mythology has in turn affected how that phenomena has been perceived within the culture.
You've described it very well. And what I need to add again, as has been said on this program recently in discussion about your doc, people who are really interested in UFOs and who are mocked, as often many are, by their friends, will be able to pull out a copy of your DVD and say, well, here, look at this. It will be the definitive demo of what UFOs are about through history of the last 50, 60 years.
That was certainly the intent in making it, to make something that would serve that kind of use. That was very much uppermost in my mind, because the simple fact of the matter is you realize very quickly when you approach the phenomena as a researcher that there's no good place to go for one-stop shopping to learn everything you need to know. I think David Jacobs' PhD thesis that was published in 1976 in book form, The UFO Controversy in America, covers the first 25 years or so, but subsequently to that, a heck of a lot has happened. And David, unfortunately, has no interest in revisiting what he did and updating his book. And other things that have been published tend to be a little bit lacking because of the forced perspective of the writers. There's an agenda there, and one feels that they're putting more into the history of the phenomenon that actually is there. See, it's something we all do, of course. I felt that there was no good one-stop shopping to go to where somebody could learn about the history of the phenomenon. And that's one of the reasons why I made the film the way I did.
And you succeeded brilliantly.
Well, thank you.
Are things in the works to distribute it all over the damn planet?
I have to check with history because there is kind of an embargo, at least within Canada, on DVD sales. Within the country. They don't want DVD sales undercutting their audience, and I believe that lasts for 1 year. However, I don't think it applies internationally. I'm almost positive that it doesn't apply internationally. But before I go ahead and actually arrange for online distribution, I also want to see about public broadcasting around the world. The first step will be to get it seen by broadcasters around the world, because I screened it for Stuart Miller, a regular contributor to your program when I was in England in May, and he felt that the production values and quality was high enough to play on the BBC, which, you know, I agree with. I certainly didn't make that with that end in mind, but I certainly feel that the production values in this film really can rank with any documentary made.
Absolutely, yes.
Ever.
Ever.
Well, maybe not ever, but certainly it can rank with films that have cost $1 million and more, even though it cost nowhere near that.
You shot a staggering amount of footage for this documentary.
Yes, I shot around 100 hours.
What are you going to do with all the excess footage?
I'm planning, should I have the time and the resources to do it, to spend the time doing it. There was a lot that couldn't fit into what's essentially an under 100-minute cut, and a lot of really good things. Incidents, for instance, that I focused on, or elongated interviews with people on various subjects. What I really like to do is to package them in a DVD set that can be distributed, and people can buy one or more of whatever interests them, that I will structure them on themes. I have probably material for maybe one at least, and possibly two or three DVDs just on abduction.
My goodness.
Some really excellent people with interviews. I'm thinking of not just David and Bud, I'm thinking of Will Boucher, for instance, who did just an absolutely marvelous interview where we explored not just John Mack, but we explored into, I hate to use the word metaphysical, but we explored into those kinds of realms regarding the abduction phenomena. And it's a really good interview, and there was utterly no way that it could be used in a 90-minute version of the film. It's unfortunate. Will was brilliant. I shot a lot, for instance, around the Malmstrom Air Force Base. I just didn't shoot an interview with Bob Salas. I shot an interview when I was out in the coast with an ex-Boeing engineer who was sent out to Montana to investigate why those missiles had shut down. And that's really a revealing interview. And also no time in the cut to even get into the Malmstrom Air Force Base incident. I would really love to do an extended DVD set and be a major resource for people to go to.
And in libraries everywhere.
That would be nice, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'd be wonderful. Oh, I hope you can put all of that together, David. I didn't know that you, for instance, had talked to Will Boucher or to Robert Salas.
Oh, yeah, I did 60 interviews. Of which I used only about 22. And of those 22, they're very short clips. The projection print, by the way, that people will be seeing at the Royal is slightly different than what's going to be going to air on History.
All the more reason to be there, then.
There's 5 minutes of material that I felt that I really missed in the History cut. The History cut stands fine by itself. And that's the cut that Stewart saw in England. But I knew
what had to be dropped.
Yeah, I knew what had to be dropped. And of the 22 minutes that I had to drop from the cut that you saw, there were 5 minutes that I really missed. And I added those back for the projection and what will be the DVD copy as well.
Good. David, I wish you success at the Royal. And I think the reaction to it across the country on the History Channel is going to be pretty damn good.
Oh, I hope so. There's a certain amount of skepticism / cynicism within the media about UFO documentaries for very good reason. The same reason I call them pulp documentaries. And trying to overcome that resistance is going to be a bit of a challenge. I have a publicist and we're on the case trying to convince people to just give it a few minutes to start watching it so they can see that it is a very different order of documentary about UFOs. And hopefully people will give it at least a few minutes and then get engrossed and look at it and then publicize the History broadcast, because it's a film that's not made for UFO folks or folks who are interested in UFOs. I think UFO folks and folks who are interested in UFOs will revel for the most part in the film, but the film is made for people who know nothing about UFOs. The film is made for people who are moderately skeptical about UFOs. That's the intended audience that I really want to reach, because their skepticism is not based upon any knowledge of the phenomena. They're missing that. So what I've attempted to do is to provide that in the film, and hopefully they'll realize that and tune in to see it. Let's hope so anyways. We'll see when the ratings come in.
Fingers, eyes, ears, nose, and toes crossed for good ratings.
Well,
David Cherniak, thank you, sir, and thank you for your documentary and all the other wonderful documentaries that you've done. And we haven't even touched Man Alive, and you being the first documentary producer to bring together the likes of Hopkins and Jacobs and abductees many, many years ago on CBC television. Maybe we can talk about that at some point in the future.
It would be nice. Thanks, Errol.
Thanks, David. Break a leg.
Happy trails.
Bye.
Bye.
First of all, Frank, let's talk a little about your reaction to the posts by Richard Hall and Jerome Clark to the UFO updates list and their reaction to your book, The Braxton County Monster.
The first book had a lot of problems with it, and I had worked for about 12 years up to the point where it was published in 2004. And to make a long, long story short, Errol, what happened is my original manuscript was close to 800 pages, double-spaced, single-sided, and publisher and editors were working on it and trying to get it down to size, fair size, where it could be printed into a hardbound edition, and we went through several drafts of editing. Well, the last couple edits, I didn't see before they went into print, and the book was actually butchered pretty bad. I had given the okay for the book to be printed, and this was about the fourth or fifth draft of the book being edited. And when I sent the disc to West Virginia from Florida, it was near perfect. I had been working with Stanton Friedman on this book, and Stanton actually wrote the foreword and an epilogue in a book. Stanton had read the final draft for the book, because I sent it to him, and when I sent it back up to the publisher, he took the book and he edited the book one, maybe two more times, I don't know, but there's approximately 150 mistakes in it.
And not knowing anything about UFOs or military installations?
No, the publisher had never attempted to do a book of this size. And when you're talking about documents, military jargon, there was up to that point 12 years of working on this book. And it was proofread by my people down here who were working with me. I worked with hundreds of people on this book. And Stanton Friedman read the final draft. And what came out in print wasn't what I had given the publisher. I mean, it had howling errors in it. And it was pretty much butchered, and it took me a few months to actually go through the book and compare what came out by the time I discovered what had happened to it. And then I had to cross-reference it. I worked with a couple other writers and English professors, and they helped me put the book back together again off of my original manuscript.
The publisher screwed it up royally to the point where you've disowned it and basically are ready to republish again with added information plus all the corrections in it.
I wrote Shoot Them Down, and it contains a good chunk of the Flatwoods Monster story in there, as well as all the summer of 1952. I start at the beginning of June 1952, and I bring it right up to the end of the summer, and I bring the Flatwoods story into it with all the corrections. And I'm just finishing up a book right now, the definitive book called The Flatwoods Monster from Myth to Reality. And it's just not about the Flatwoods Monster, Errol. It's about the September 12th UFO sightings that occurred around the United States. And by working with Stanton, we've concluded this seems to be the biggest UFO flap in American history.
It would certainly seem like that when you consider the amount of sightings that you've gathered from several different places.
Right.
For instance, you got a lot of reports from Project Blue Book.
Yes.
Which, at the time that that case broke, was all classified.
Right. The Flatwoods incident occurred on September 12, 1952. And there was a couple of fellows who actually investigated this case. Gray Barker was one of the first, Ivan T. Sanderson, and Donald Kehoe. Kehoe didn't actually go to Flatwoods like the other fellows. He investigated this through his sources in the Pentagon. And all these guys wrote about these different sightings and what was going on over Flatwoods. And Sanderson actually spread out a little bit, and he had a few other areas that he went into detail where these sightings were, but they didn't have the gold piece. And the key to this whole thing was Project Blue Book. And Blue Book actually gave the majority of the details that I wrote this book from.
That was after all those files were declassified.
That was in 76, and none of the original investigators ever went back into the case and tried figuring it out. I don't know if they looked at them, but they never wrote that they did. There's no history of that. And everything is well documented in that Blue Book file. It's unbelievable the amount of sightings that occurred that night.
The Blue Book cases that you looked into, were they on hard copy or were they in
files?
They were microfilm.
I was quite surprised because I have other Blue Book microfilm reels, and they would cover, the average one would cover weeks at a time. Almost the whole microfilm reel that I got for September 12th and 13th were for those 2 days alone.
Whoa.
Which was amazing.
That would be a substantial number of sightings, it seems.
Yeah, there was about 200 pages for the 12th and 13th, because there was a lot of follow-up in the same areas the next day. The one thing I want your listeners to understand, Errol, is all these references that I have, they're all documented. And I traveled to dozens of libraries around the country. The primary sources I used were Blue Book. I used newspaper articles from around the United States. Stanton Friedman spoke to Barry Greenwood in Massachusetts, and he sent articles from his private collection. And some of them are just Xerox copies, and they're the only ones in existence. I talk with witnesses over different parts of West Virginia around the country, and a big advantage I have is I live near Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, which has one of the biggest aeronautical libraries in the world. And I actually used some of the original official airline guides from 1952 magazines. Then I used aeronautical maps, topographical maps, and regional maps. And this is how I was able to put together the flight path trajectories. I figured out there was over 100 locations over 9 states over approximately about a 20-hour time period where these UFOs were seen. This wasn't just a couple UFOs seen here and there up in the mountains. There was quite a few of them. Project Blue Book actually didn't list 3 of the states within their documents. I found these out of newspaper articles. And it's basically a paper trail. Blue Book had hardcore evidence. And then from those points, I went into other states and other areas. And when I linked up and started plotting these different points, I started forming flight path trajectories. I got newspapers, magazine articles. And what I did, Errol, is I got aeronautical maps. And I pieced about 10 of them together, and they covered a whole wall.
I was going to ask about that, because it seems to me that if you're covering, what you said, 9 states?
Right. And at first, I only found a handful of states, and I was working with small maps. But then I got a couple aeronautical maps, and then when I found out that there was 9 East Coast states, I couldn't believe it. And one of the military guys I worked with, he's an Air Force guy, he says, Frank, you better get the whole East Coast and map this thing. It costs a few bucks to buy these maps.
Yeah.
And pieced them all together and hung them up on the wall. And for probably about 7 to 8 years, I had this map hanging up. And every time I found new information or where I traveled throughout the country, or Friedman sent me something new, I got a new piece of information, I would plot the points on this map. And there's over 100 locations at different times where they were seen.
You talked about Xerox copies of things that you got. Now, those old Xerox machines and the printing that they did were notorious for fading. And you look at old photocopies or Xerox copies, as they were then, the Xerox Corporation, they didn't last very long in files, did they?
No, they didn't. And actually, it was Stanton Friedman who had told me what happened is when the Xeroxes were made, they were basically laid out somewheres. And the Air Force person who was in charge of photographing them for Blue Book, for the microfilm archives, would just go along and take photographs of all of them, and that's what was put onto the microfilm. Well, some of them sat around for a long time.
So you've got Xerox copies that sat around for a long time before they were photographed for the microfiche.
And faded.
And faded. And then you've got the deterioration of the film itself.
Right. Actually, for me to figure out, it's about 200 pages, Errol. About 5.5 years it took me to go through, and I actually re-inked and went over a lot of the handwriting and documents.
Now, you're not an amateur at this. You're a calligraphist, and you're also a damn fine artist, too.
Yeah, it was 4 years trained, Perry College of Art in New Haven. It's up near Yale University. And then I went to film and video production school for 2 years. So I had the patience to do this, and actually it got to be fun because I would start reading these documents. The information was mind-boggling in there, so you want to get another page and you want to try to figure something else out. Some of the pages were so bad, I had to enlarge the 8x10 Xerox pages up to 2x3 feet.
Whoa.
To try to get the lettering as big as I could. And I actually worked with a couple people who analyzed handwriting, because some of the witnesses on these tentative observers questionnaires, they were handwritten pieces. And you had to figure out the way and the curvature and how this person wrote. And I was able to get about 99% of it in detail over that 5+ years. And then I had to put it all together. That was the fun part.
Well, to be honest, I can't see any other researcher on the planet bothering to do that.
Yeah, it was quite a undertaking. And I'm in my 17th year now, and I'm still going through stuff.
So consequently, the great majority of the UFO researchers have no clue about what those microfiche pages contained.
No, they had no idea. I had no idea. Errol, you have no idea of the amount of information that was in there. It was unbelievable. There were military observers, civilian observers. There was actually thousands of people that night over 9 states who were reporting everything that was being seen. And I have hundreds of newspaper articles as well that, like I said earlier, when I would find a location where a UFO was seen according to the Blue Book files, then I would look in that regional paper. It's just a big paper trail and connecting the dots.
And as you said, from the sound of it, the biggest UFO flap in history, except nobody knew about it.
No, they didn't. Nobody ever took the time to piece this together. At the beginning, I had no idea of the magnitude of the case until I started plotting the points and saying this was a very serious thing that happened this night.
So you had 200 pages of Project Blue Book data on microfilm.
Right. There was close to about 180 pages just on September 12th. And there was 20, 25 pages for the follow-up night. Blue Book did not list 3 of the states of the 9 that I figured out where there was sightings. And as I started going through everything, I figured out where all these sightings took place. And if any of your listeners live in these states, they can actually help and further the research, because I'm not going to spend another 17 years on this case looking at the documents. But here's where the UFO sightings took place. Over Delaware, Maryland, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Virginia, Washington, D.C., and West Virginia. Those were the East Coast states. There were actually 2 other states, California and Illinois, that had sightings that night, but they didn't link or tie into directly what was going on the East Coast. And what was interesting, Errol, is that as I'm going through all these documents and then I started reading some of these newspaper reports and magazine articles, there was a majority of these sightings that were all reported to the Pentagon and Air Force bases. And some of them actually went to the Air Defense Command headquarters in Colorado. And the newspapers said that there was hundreds and thousands of reports within the state that went to state police, local police, airports, government agencies, Civil Aeronautics Administration officials. I mean, this wasn't something small. This was massive. And it occurred over about 20-hour time period. And the bottom line, which is the Air Force's official statement of what they said all of these sightings were attributed to, was a single meteor. Which is quite hilarious. It was what they called it is the well-known Washington area meteor. That's what it was dubbed.
And there were no crash test dummies leaping out of that meteor,
no.
Right?
No, but something came out of one of them, and it was about 12 foot tall, landed in Flatwoods.
Well, yeah, exactly.
And what's interesting is right within the own Blue Book documentations, they're talking about this meteor that was seen throughout the East Coast area, but they were actually UFOs. And they were seen over the course of hours over different areas flying at treetop level in some cases. And there was actually one instance where something was over Greensboro, North Carolina, Washington, D.C. at the same time, and they blamed it on the same meteor. But they were flying low level, hundreds of miles apart. You know, it's just a lot of information.
It sounds like search and rescue, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
And that, I think that's what you theorized at one point, wasn't it?
Yes. When I put all of these flight paths together, I figured out over these 100 locations, there were 4 damaged objects that night.
Hmm.
And they had made repeated landings, had pieces falling off of them. They were exploding. They were seen in flames. They had sparks coming off of them. And what I did, Errol, is I went through all of these different areas and I plotted points. Okay? And I got a lot of information out of Blue Book and newspapers. And actually, some of them, West Virginia, some of the local residents told me some of the things that happened up there that weren't reported to Blue Book. And I was able to figure out that there was actually 12 different crash landing sites that night.
Or landing sites.
No, or, crash no, landing
crash
sites.
Crash landing sites.
Where these things, they were forced down. These were the objects that were in flames, had pieces falling off of them. And they made repeated landings, took off and traveled and landed again. So basically, they were forced down. They were damaged.
Mm.
And I also have other individual landing sites where you talked earlier about the search and rescue mission.
Yeah.
There was actually a UFO that went down up in the Wheeling area. And there was a 2-hour flap of UFO sightings that occurred in the Ohio and West Virginia area. And you have to imagine how many people saw these things dropping out of the sky for 2 hours. That's all documented. 2 hours of UFO sightings where these things were plunging out of the sky. Let me read a couple articles for you. I'll just read you the headlines. Fireball shower city area. Mystery lights zip through skies here, stirring mild furor. They were called flashing meteors, fiery objects. Authorities probe flashes in area skies. Flaming objects seen at the Capitol. Fiery object in sky stirs saucer reports in 4 states. I have pages of these reports.
So you triangulate using witness testimony and reports, and you say there were how many, you figured, crash sites?
Between Blue Book, newspaper reports, and local eyewitnesses. From plotting all these points, on September 12, 1952, there were 12 crash landing sites.
Wow.
That involved 4 damaged craft. And I haven't pinpointed and documented to a T. And throughout the years there, when I was traveling around, going to archives, libraries, I was doing interviews, I spent a lot of time in West Virginia. At one point, I was spending more time in West Virginia than I was at home. And I would go up there for weeks on end, and just traveling around. And I was able to go to the majority of these areas where all these things landed. And actually, one of the objects landed in Tennessee. And it flew about 100 miles through the Oak Ridge National Laboratory, no-fly zone. Everybody missed that. And it landed in the small town of Arcadia, just short of Oak Ridge. And I didn't go to that archive, but I wrote the archive, and they sent me an article. And on one of my West Virginia trips, I shot into Tennessee and went into that area. And I found out from a headline there, it was called Sky Objects Seen Here, Search Ends for Wrecked Aircraft. And this aircraft landed in Tennessee. And I got to read you this one quote, Errol, because this is a killer one. Okay, you ready? Sky objects seen here, search ends for wrecked aircraft. An ambulance and the Kingsport life-saving crew and first aid crew sped to the area and stood by after patrolmen reported sighting what they believed to be distress flares from the ground where the object was supposed to have fallen. Whoa. Now, what I did is I also tracked this UFO, and it came across the eastern seaboard into Virginia, flew southwest over Arcadia, penetrated the no-fly zone for about 100 miles, and crash-landed in this little town here. It was seen by hundreds of people, and they thought it was a small plane that went down. But in the area where it was seen to go down, there were distress flares being shot up. They didn't find it because the thing left and moved away, and I went through all the papers in Tennessee, and I tracked this thing going back through Tennessee again, and it crashed a short ways later. Then there was another UFO that flew over Baltimore, Maryland. This object was documented in dozens of reports.
Doing the same thing?
This one flew over Baltimore and went on a northwest trajectory in the opposite direction, and it actually was making a beeline towards Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And if you look on a map, you will see that Wright-Patterson is situated due north over Oak Ridge, Tennessee.
Ah.
Oak Ridge National Laboratory.
Right.
So the third object came right down the middle and flew over Washington, D.C., and that was what was reported as the well-known Washington area meteor. And it was documented in the Boston Globe and also documented in the New York Times. They called it the flame over Washington. So there were three UFOs that came in over the eastern seaboard. I worked with pilots, astronomers, scientists, different jet people, and I even worked with a tower control man and a couple police officers. And we all looked at my research, and one guy in particular helped me figure out what was going on that night. And it was actually a triangular pattern that went back off the eastern seaboard. And when these UFOs all came and damaged and in pieces, they split in three different directions. One went towards Oak Ridge. One went towards Wright-Patterson. The third one came down the middle and went due west. It flew over at treetop level at some areas, because this thing was going up and down, it was being maneuvered, and it flew over Washington, D.C. It flew about 200 miles due west and flew into Braxton County. Now, we know what happened in Braxton County.
The Flatwoods Monster.
Right. I was able to track this thing across the United States. It actually went off course, hit upper Braxton County, the northern tip of the county, and it made a 45-degree angle turn and came down and actually followed the main artery road and flew between the mountains going through Braxton County and flew over the school playground. Then it turned back and it landed up on the Bailey Fisher Farm. So this is well documented. Nobody had ever pieced this whole thing together. And Blue Book was great for telling times. For telling when an object was seen. It was given in military time, local time, the hardest part was figuring out, because the country back then wasn't in uniformity for the times. There was daylight savings time, standard time. West Virginia was actually in two different time zones. Wheeling was in daylight time, the northern panhandle, and the rest of the state was in standard time, and Washington, D.C., and states along the eastern seaboard were in daylight savings time. So I even found some errors in the military documents, because it's confusing trying to figure out times that this thing was seen here and there. One of the objects actually changed into three different time zones as it was flying across the country, and it was turning and going over different states. So the biggest pain in the neck was figuring out what the true time of it was when it was seen, because there were so many of them that night and so many were flying over different areas. You had to be a little bit crazy there.
All these crash craft, and I'm thinking specifically of the one that was near the Oak Ridge Labs, people saw it come down. Did anybody see it take off?
When they got to the area, the thing had taken off already, and then it landed a short distance away.
It had taken off, and then other witnesses saw it land again?
Right. All documented, and It gives explicit details where it landed. And that section in Tennessee, I actually went to it a few years ago, and I went to the different areas. And I always document everything. I always have video cameras and still cameras, and it gives me a better feel of what's going on. And what I did in a lot of cases, Errol, is when I was actually writing this book and putting timelines together. Timelines are so important, especially when you're dealing with something over a 20-hour period. I would go to these different locations, and I would track the mileage between points, because the newspapers and the witnesses I spoke with, and Keogh spoke about this, and Sanderson spoke about it, all the different police officers that were going out and going to these crash sites and then going back to headquarters and moving and going here and there. I reenacted everything that happened in Braxton County that night. I went up with friends. I actually went around with eyewitness Freddie May, some of the locals in the area, some of the old-timers who know those hollers. Now, you don't want to get lost driving around with some of those hollers, believe me. and I did on a couple of cages. It got to be scary.
That must have been pretty bizarre when the listener remembers the movie Deliverance.
Yeah. Yeah. Not a far cry in some places. When you get out of some of the town areas and you start going into these hollers and along some of these places where some of these things were going down, you don't travel alone. And several of the locals were laughing when I told them where I went and I got lost, and they would take me into these areas. We would hit the trip gauge and we would figure out the mileage in between and how far it was from point to point and how long it took the sheriff to get from point A to B, and we reenacted the whole thing. But this took years, Errol. This wasn't something we did in a day. And this is how I was able to figure out the things that were going on that night. So I combined all that information with the Blue Book stuff and the newspaper articles, and I put together this massive timeline, worked with all the maps and plotted everything. That's how we were able to figure out what was going on that night.
So the question, Frank Fascino,
yes,
is, you say 9 states, 12 crash landings, and a bunch of those in West Virginia.
10 of them, actually. 10 crash landings in West Virginia.
The question is, what the hell caused those things to crash land?
Well, this is what my second book was based on. 1952 had the highest amount of UFO sightings in Blue Book's history. And when I started researching a little bit earlier to the beginning of the summer, I found out that it was in the press in a couple different papers that jet pilots are operating under a 24-hour nationwide alert to chase the mysterious objects and to shoot them down if they ignore orders to land. This particular quote was in the Fall River Herald News, Massachusetts newspaper on July 29th. And there's some other newspaper articles that talk about that. And it was even General Roger Ramey. He was the deputy chief of the Air Force Staff of Operations. And he stated that the interceptor planes have raced aloft several hundred times as a result of the UFO sightings. And I found out from an old newspaper article that Kehoe actually quotes the number closer to about 300 when through his sources. So there was a lot of stuff going on.
There was a shoot 'em down order.
Right.
the biggest flap in UFO history happened.
September 12th. Now, this is just a few weeks after this order was made public.
Okay.
They had been doing this right along. And bang, here we go. We have approximately 20 hours of UFO sightings and things crashing all over the place. Now, Errol, that was 12 crash landing sites. I have seven other sites where UFOs were dropping out of the sky and touching the ground and going in a grid perimeter area where a crashed UFO went down earlier looking for it. And it's amazing when you look at a map and you see this pinpoint in the middle. It was actually in the Wheeling Panhandle where this thing went down, and you pinpoint all these things and you could see where they were dropping out of the sky. This is what the Wheeling Intelligence are called, the sky objects and shower of things coming out of the sky. And for 2 hours they did this, and then they just disappeared.
Your book, Shoot Them Down, covers the summer of 52.
Right.
So that's previous to the biggest unheard of flap in UFO
history. Right. Well, what I did in Shoot Them Down is I realized it was going to take 10 lifetimes to go through all the documents. The Norton Air Force Base Aircraft Accident Reports had been released from that era. And Friedman got me a bunch of them, and I started going through them, and it was a nightmare. Cover up in a lot of instances, and it takes months to go through these reports and digest them and cut them up and dissect them and try to figure out what they're saying. And I found a lot of howling mistakes and cover-ups and conspiracy things going on within these reports. But what I did is I had been going through the New York Times, and I found out between 1951 and 56, there was over a couple hundred plane crashes and jets that had vanished and disappeared. And there was actually 192 crashes that occurred over the United States during that time.
So that was happening before and after this major UFO event.
Right. I was able to find an old article about a shoot down order was still in operation. It was called Shoot to Kill by the United States Navy. And the Fullerton News Tribune, July 26, 56 article, they talk about this, shoot to kill orders. And the shoot them down was disclosed in 52. So you have years of stuff going on here. And then you have all these mysterious crashes going on.
Timothy Good has suggested that there were over 1,000 planes shot down.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how he came to that conclusion. Do you know?
I don't know, Errol. I haven't read his book. I haven't had the time yet.
I haven't seen it.
I'm going to give you some statistics, though, that Stan Friedman found in National Archives. He found a declassified confidential memorandum dated September 10, 52, and it's a tabulation of major accidents. And I went through and I did a breakdown, and I'm going to tell you the June and July statistics. These are just fighter aircraft, not cargo, not transport. In June of 52, the Air Force reported 100 major accidents and 36 aircraft destroyed and 21 fighter fatalities. In July, they gave a preliminary report and said it had jumped up. There was 135 major accidents. Fighter aircrafts only, there were 58 destroyed and 30 fatalities. So when you combine June and July 1952, this confidential memorandum, Lieutenant Colonel Myers, there's your name, there was 235 major fighter accidents, 94 were destroyed and 51 men killed. That's just June and July.
Wow. And do you have comparative statistics for the years before and the years after?
I have a couple of them that Friedman was able to find, but what's interesting, Errol, is the month that I wanted in particular was September 52.
Yeah.
It's gone.
Really?
Yeah, it's missing. It was taken out of the box. Stanton was actually up at a conference when he had found these, and he had an afternoon to himself, and he ran over there and looked through, and I said, Stanton, specifically go through June, July, all the way through the rest of the year, and there was a lot of stuff missing, but the primary month that I wanted, September, was gone.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Most of these aircraft that went down were flown by experienced pilots. They'd been through World War II and the Korean War.
A lot of veterans. And I actually was able to find 20 cases of combat veterans. Now, this is my New York Times research.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't the whole ball of wax. As like I said, you couldn't live 10 lifetimes and analyze everything. But I'll read off a quick list to you of 9 of the fellas that I know of, according to the New York Times, gave their combat mission statistics. 182 combat missions, 130, 105, 100, 185, 81, 70, and 32. 4 of these men were aces.
And you'd think, with the loss of the aircraft and these experienced fighter pilots,
right,
there would have been boards of inquiry.
Exactly. We have 4 aces, and all of these combat veterans either vanished or crashed in the United States, Errol.
Did you come across any evidence of boards of inquiry looking into these accidents?
A couple of them that I went through from the summer of 52, which are in Shoot 'Em Down, are a complete disgrace. And I show all the inaccuracies within the book. I mean, it's a crying shame, some of the ridiculous explanations that were given. These reports go from 60 to over 100 pages long.
Oh,
it's not like you whip them out and you read through them in a day. They take months to go through.
Were they the only reports that were available to you, or do you know if there were boards of inquiry into every one of those accidents?
I don't know. I haven't seen all of them. I only have a few different reels that I'm going through.
And that's microfiche again?
Yes.
And that's another horrendous ocular headache, yeah.
Same headache going through everything again. So it's quite a task. You know, there's some other people trying to do the same thing. That's why when I went through the accident reports on the New York Times, you don't run into that problem. My final tally, between 51 and 56, it was 204 fighter aircraft accidents. Now, these are destroyed aircraft. This isn't a plane that where a bolt fell out or it crashed on the runway because its wheel fell off. These are major accidents, which are considered beyond repair. They were destroyed. 204 aircraft destroyed. This is what I found in the Times. 229 fighter aircraft were destroyed in those 204 incidents. And what was interesting is there was 12 multiple jet crashes, Errol. Between 2 and 4 jets crashed at once in formation.
Mm.
Squadrons all went down out of the sky. No mid-air collisions.
Well, how does that happen, huh?
That's a good question. And most of the newspaper reports, they'll say right in there, the Air Force, you know, has no explanation for this. They're in the dark. We don't know what to explain. And the press had reporters out there looking at this stuff. There's a lot of pictures in the New York Times. It took me a few years to go through and find all of these and print them out and put them in order and decipher what was going on. The interesting part of those 204 incidents, I found there was at least 199 fighter pilots and radar operators killed.
Well,
this is not mid-air collision between fighters and non-fighter aircraft, because there was a lot of those era where a Starfire would collide with a cargo plane and 40 guys would die.
Mm-hmm.
I don't include those.
Yeah, and all this happened in a space of 8 weeks.
No, these statistics here were from 51 to 56,
okay,
according to the New York Times. The other statistic that I gave you earlier, the June and July, that was an Air Force memorandum that Stanton Friedman found. September 10th, 52 memorandum for the June and July fighter accidents.
What an amazing amount of research you've done, and there's just so much of it, Frank, that I get confused,
yeah.
And I'm amazed that you don't. There's no wonder that there are some UFO researchers who have said, well, that's all nonsense, because how could they possibly have done the research?
Yeah, it would take them 17 years to catch up to me.
And if they happen to be willing and able to come to your place and go through all the documentation that you have, they undoubtedly would agree with you rather than disagree.
They would spend weeks in my storage unit and have to lift 4 tons of books and research.
Oh, my.
It's something I want to read you that came right real quick, Errol, from the Project Blue Book reports.
Mm-hmm.
Tentative witness questionnaires were... If a witness saw an object, they would report to the Air Force, and the Air Force would send them a 10-page questionnaire. How big was the object? What direction was it seen flying in? What do you think it was? 10
yeah.
pages of questions
yeah,
like
yeah.
that. And I went through, especially just for this interview, and I'm going to read out some of the key ones that were reported by the witnesses. This guy was a Department of Army witness, and he was asked about this object. And he said the object was near enough for us to debate stopping the car for fear of what might happen when it landed. This was over Virginia. Another one, it stated, in your opinion, what do you think the object was? And this guy wrote, I don't know. The newspapers said it was a meteor, but it had no tail and was not falling. It was larger than any meteor that I ever saw. And another guy snapped back and he wrote, this is your job. I've seen many meteors. This was not one. It was much too large. It did not fall towards the Earth. And there's just pages of Blue Book reports of stuff like this going on. And people were reporting these things that looked like a plane on fire. And I have a real interesting piece here that came out of a newspaper. I want to read this to you, Errol. This came out of the Washington, D.C. paper. This is talking about the object that flew over Washington, which is called the Flame Over Washington. This was actually a United Press news correspondent. He said it plunged out of the sky very fast, like a plane shot down in a war. It was trailing a tail of flame.
It fell. It didn't glide.
It plunged out of the sky very fast, like a plane shot down in the war.
Yeah, they go straight down.
Here's another guy. Suddenly, this thing came swooping down from the eastern skies. It looked like it was right above the treetops. It was a ball of greenish fire with a long tail. And this is one of my favorites. I thought it was a flare until the darn thing swooped down and then up again. It seemed to follow the contours of the road. This was an Army veteran. And we have about 20 hours of this stuff of hundreds of witnesses talking about all these things. Now, what's interesting is all those crash landings that occurred in West Virginia, those 10 that I told you about earlier, I worked with some astronomers and I worked with scientists and we tried finding out about these different meteors that were said to have landed in West Virginia. There was never any impact pits. There was never any sonic booms. And one of my astronomer buddies found me the Smithsonian Institute catalog for meteorites. And he sent it to me, the West Virginia segment. Now, there was 10 landings in the state, repeated landings being made by these different objects. So you think there would be some type of a record in those areas where meteorites had fallen. Now, the Smithsonian catalog reported there's only been 3 in West Virginia history. One was the Greenbrier County meteorite. That was found in 1880. There was another one called the Jenny's Creek meteorite. That was a 27-pounder, and that was 1883. And the Landes meteorite, which was a 150-pound meteorite found in Grant County. That was 1930, nothing for 1952. So while I was working with Stanton over the years toward the end of my research with these meteors, we found out that the Harvard Meteor Project was in existence from 1952 to 54. And it's interesting, Dr. Menzel was working on this project, of all people.
Donald Menzel, the arch debunker.
Yeah, exactly. Now, what's interesting is this Harvard Meteor Project was in existence on September 12th, 1952. And during their 2 years, they actually had obtained 2,401 meteor orbits that they had photographed. Now, there are none for September 12th. There are no records in the world in any astronomy book or any history book of a meteor or meteorite shower on September 12, 1952, except in Project Blue Book.
In the imagination of the Air Force.
Right. And this is one fellow who saw a UFO over Maryland that night. The Air Force had written to him, please add any further comments which you would believe to be important. And this fellow wrote back, for a person with limited knowledge about things of this nature, an opinion advance may be of too little value. I don't know what it was I saw, and I will insist on what it was, capital letters, not. I have seen meteors, and the newspapers will have a hard time telling me I was looking at a meteor on September 12th. Maybe it sounds good to persons who didn't see the object. This, in capital letters, quote, thing was being flown.
Well, you can't argue with that, can you?
There's just tons of stuff like this throughout Blue Book. And like I said earlier, Errol, we could spend a month on the radio doing it. But it's all documented. It's all hardcore. It's all here. It's interesting because I actually had a guy at one of my lectures, when he saw my master map, he says, well, maybe it was a meteor that exploded off the East Coast and those three pieces went, and they just happened to go to those strategic places. One happened to Flower, Washington. One went towards Elk Ridge, and one went towards Great Bat. And I'm like, are you out of your mind? They just happened to. There wasn't any meteors on that day. And what's very interesting is I actually have some topographical and aeronautical maps from 51 and 52, Errol, from talking to these different people in bookstores, actually maps from that era. And they showed the flight path corridors. Some of these objects were actually flying and following these corridors. Honest to God, they were following these flight path corridors. And some of them, in some cases, were actually following the beacons of the airports, going from point to point to point to point to point. And a lot of fellas have looked at my map, mostly Air Force, Marine Corps, and Navy fellas, Army fellas.
Aviators, yeah.
Yeah, and they're like, this is amazing. Do you know what you have here, Frank? This is a search and rescue mission. These objects went down, and certain ones followed in looking for them. If you didn't know they were UFOs, you would think this was a modern operation in warfare. There's actually documentation, Errol, where these things, when they were flying from airport beacon to beacon, there were three cases where commercial airline pilots saw them, and one of these objects, it was one of the big oval-shaped UFOs, the one that had flown over Baltimore earlier, nearly clipped the plane and collided in midair with it. This thing was damaged, and it was flying around the country, and I plotted the points of this thing across the United States, and it almost collided with a plane.
Wow. All of these UFO sightings that happened on September the 12th, 1952... Were there any military aircraft seen at the same time?
There are reports in Blue Book of pilots being in the air and reporting shooting stars.
Was that back then a code word for unidentified?
I don't know. They just said it was actually a Navy pilot over the Patuxent River, and there was two different occasions down in North Carolina, one of them where a service report was actually given, and these UFOs were seen over that area.
But there were no civilian witnesses on the ground who saw fighter aircraft?
No. All the action seems to point off the East Coast, because when you take all the flight path trajectories and go back off the East Coast of the United States, they all intersect about 90 miles off the eastern seaboard. I do have the accident reports from September 12, 1952 from Norton Air Force Base. And one case I had worked on for about 10 years was the Delcurto and Jones case, where an F-94B Starfire vanished off the planet about half an hour before the thing landed in Flatwoods. It disappeared off the coast of Florida. For several years, I called the Air Force archives, I called people all over the United States, and I found out these men were never born, they never died, they were never in the Air Force, and there's no documentation, no Social Security death index, nobody had a record of these guys. But I was holding 10 newspaper articles from Florida that spoke about the incident.
Did they name names in the newspaper articles?
Yeah, the name of the pilot, Second Lieutenant John Jones and John Delcurto. Well, I contacted the brothers, and I spoke to the brothers, and I actually got the Air Defense Command documents from one of the brothers that General Chidlaw had sent them. Well, for years, the Air Force claimed they had no records until the Norton Air Force Base accident reports came out. Now, I had been on this case for about 10 years already, so when I went through all of these documents for this particular case, it was a crying shame what they said happened. And I wrote that in Shoot 'Em Down. It was the biggest tragedy I ever read in my life. It was so covered up and ass backwards. I've had pilots coming up to me very upset who have read the book, and they said it's a disgrace what happened and the crap that was given and the excuses for that night. And what's also interesting is there was also a couple other cases on September 12, 52 that were yanked and went to higher classification on September 12th. So why?
Yeah.
Why were cases yanked? And they were actually the cases that were in front of and back of the Jones and Del Curto case, September 12, 52.
Along with all the other records from that time disappeared.
Right. But these were the newly classified documents on microfilm. Mm. When I was going along through the microfilm, they would say case number one, then you scroll case number two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, 10, 11, all the way up. And the Jones and Del Curto case was there, but there's no record of the case before or after.
Well, that's odd.
They're gone. There's not even a number there referencing. So if you're going through that microfilm real fast, you don't even realize there's any cases missing. It's just because the cases that bookend, I paid close attention to that particular case. So there were accidents yanked for that particular day. A lot of fishy things going on.
Seems like, Frank, when you look at that time period and the weirdness that was going on, but there was no access to Project Blue Book documents. As we said, they were classified. There was no opportunity for a UFO researcher to go in there and...
Because it was so big, it was shotgun all over the United States.
Yep.
Now look, I'm in my 17th year on it, and I'm still finding out information. Like I said earlier, Errol, there was a surveys report, communications instructions for the reporting of vital intelligence sightings. In other words, it's a red alert. And a C-46 aircraft on September 12th had one of these damaged UFOs, flew right in front of it.
And
a surveys report was filed.
Service, yes, C-E-R-V-I-S.
Right, on September 12th, 52. They had observed one unidentified flying object traveling at a heading of approximately 330 degrees. It was directly over Greensboro, North Carolina, directly over it.
Wow.
You know what it was written off as you went through the hierarchy through Blue Book?
Mm.
It was written off as the September 12th, 1952 meteor. And it was flying at a low altitude over Greensboro. Hundreds of miles away, they blamed it on the one that flew at treetop level over Washington.
Who was going to see these reports? Who was going to argue with them?
Yeah, who would pick up on stuff like this?
It's taken until the next century for a Frank Fascino to pop up and say, hello, excuse me, look at all of this.
And some of the witnesses, Errol, they even picked up and they would explain, they would give dimensions and descriptions. Listen to this one. It was round and yellowish-orange in color, and it looked like it dropped in Mill Hollow or the Hollow to the right. This is in Cabin Creek, West Virginia. It seemed to be 20 to 30 feet across. I don't think it was a meteor because it looked like it stopped right in the midair just before it came down.
No.
We have dozens of reports of like this. The light seemed to go out just before the thing hit, and it looked like a faint puff of smoke where it landed. These are all landings around the country. Here's one of my favorites. The Gazette switchboard was deluged with calls from anxious Charlestonians who saw the object. Okay, now listen to this one. It made a sort of putt-putt noise. It had sparkles around it. It was exploding. Okay, and here's one of the best parts. A piece of it fell off near the airport. This one had actually followed the flight path down from the panhandle and flew into central West Virginia. The object was variously reported to have made hissing noises and to have, quote, backed up and started over.
Of course, we've all seen meteors that do that, right?
Right. Now, the thing about the, quote, well-known Washington area meteor of 12 September, they said it landed near Flatwoods. Nothing was ever found in Flatwoods. Hmm. Now, this object was seen and said to have been about the size of a two-car garage. It was pretty good size.
Wow.
Errol, you would know what the ground would look like if an object that size hit the ground, and the speed of it was said to have been going about 27 miles per second. It would be called flattened woods. There would be no flat woods or all the other locations throughout the state, 10 in total of crash landings. That state would have been devastated if that was a meteor shower. So would Ohio, and there were objects seen over Pennsylvania up in the Pittsburgh area, too.
We would have certainly found holes in the ground.
Impact
craters.
Pits.
Yeah, exactly.
There was not one found. And it was said that duration of the meteor that flew over Washington, it was seen for 5 to 6 seconds. That's the official write-up on it.
Well, we all know how much faith we put in official write-ups anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. 5 to 6 seconds.
Yeah.
And you know, it's funny, the description that they actually give of this thing, it came from an astronomy club in Akron, Ohio, who had seen it. The description of it is exactly what the witnesses told me the thing looked like was flying around in Flatwoods. Yep. Egg-shaped with smaller radius in front, bluish-green at the rear. Blue Book based their final report on an astronomy club write-up. They supposedly saw it. We don't know if they ever wrote this up or who wrote this.
And, of course, all those guys are gone now anyway.
Mm-hmm. And they called it a fireball meteor, and then the reports dubbed it the well-known Washington area meteor.
I'm sure the listener has just a pile of questions, Frank.
Mm-hmm.
And probably the best way to do this is let's leave it open for you to be on the program again.
Okay.
And if the listener wants to email questions for you, I'll pass them on to you,
and we'll
have you on again. And let's keep going through this till people get the idea that this was the biggest flap in UFO history.
You go on my website, flatwoodsmonster.com. I have pictures of my map up there, my master map that I use.
But does it blow up real good so we can actually close-up look at it?
You can get a good look at it. You get an idea of it and the size of this thing, but at some point it's going to be hard to read because I have hundreds of notes and stickers and details all over this thing when I was trying to figure it out, and I left it as is. So it's a historical piece.
I was kind of being dumbassed about that.
You know,
when you say a whole wall, well, that's not going to fit on a website. You have a big event coming up in September in West Virginia, don't you, Frank?
Right, September 12th and 13th, the 2008 Flatwoods Monster and Flying Saucer Extravaganza. And Brothers Bennett Bailey Promotions is going to be running it, and we're going to hold it and the new St. Albans Art Conference Center in St. Albans. And the theme of this year is going to be the Flatwoods Monster meets the Mothman. And I'm actually going to meet up with Jeff Wamsley, who's the Mothman author and expert. And he runs the museum up there in Point Pleasant. And we're going to meet for the first time here in West Virginia. And we're going to bring all of our research in. I'm going to have my Flatwoods research. He's going to have his Mothman research. And we're going to display all these exhibits and some of my paintings, original artwork, my maps. And I'm going to give a slide and lecture. And I'm going to show my Shoot 'Em Down movie over this two-day period, which is September 12th and 13th. And we're bringing Stanton Friedman in for this as well. And we're going to have other special guests there, Chad Lambert, John Ventry. He's MUFON director for Pennsylvania and West Virginia. A lot of different people are going to be there, and we're expecting a good crowd.
Good. Frank Pacino, thank you. I'm glad we spent more time together, and I suggest that the listeners go back to the program archive and go listen to the first two, because the first two – and go back and listen to the first two programs that we did with you and Stan and Alfred Lemberg, because there are all kinds of other details there. This is just fleshing out some of the Air Force Project Blue Book stuff, the newspapers, and what was going on there. The Flatwoods Monster case itself is fascinating. Thank you, Frank Fascino.
Thanks, Errol. I appreciate you having me on. Hopefully we could straighten a little bit of this out here for the people who aren't aware of what happened that night.
I wish there was a way of putting all this together so that it was easy for people to follow along.
Right. If it was easy, everybody would be doing it. Right?
But I'm thinking, well, you spent 17 years putting all of this information together. Now, how the hell do you disseminate it without boggling people's minds?
The new book, The Flatwoods Monster, From Myth to Reality, I go into explicit detail, and I actually have different reference lists that I break down, and the story is quite an easy read. Nobody's touched it. I'm my own editor on it. We
Good.
Don't want to have that happen again.
Oh, the perils of first-time authors and small publishers. Whoa.
Yep.
Thanks, Frank.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Bye. If you have questions for Frank, please feel free, email us, sdi@virtuallystrange.net, and we will indeed get Frank back on again to answer those questions.
Let's give him something to talk about, babe. A little mystery to figure out. Let's give him something to talk about.
As we do every other program, we head down to Enterprise, Alabama. And Alfred Lemberg joins us. And this time, Alfred has a particular interest in what we've been talking about, because Alfred has probably been the only one on the UFO updates list who has come to Frank Fascino's aid. Not that it's done much good, Alfred Lemberg.
Well, you know, I'm probably not supposed to. Just consider for a moment what you and Dave Frelott were talking about in the very first portion of the program. And it cannot be argued, I think, that you were both very critical of Jerry Clark and Richard Hall. And it was not so much as an attack, I think, but more of an expression of disappointment with their very needlessly prejudiced attitudes. In that vein, I'm probably just as disappointed as you guys are.
I'm not surprised at Richard Hall, but I am somewhat at Jerry Clark, because Jerry tends to get all of his ducks in a row before he responds.
That's the point. These two especially, they're coming across very debunkery-like, when you would expect behavior 180 degrees out. You and Dave are certainly to be commended for speaking out as you have on this stuff. Because, you see, it's not just UFOs, and it's not just about UFOs. It's about 199 men, to start, that were lost, doing their duty as they were ordered to do it. If what they were involved with, if all that stuff had nothing to do with UFOs, if guys were just out there running out of gas, or chasing planets and balloons, or flying into each other out of blithering incompetence, it doesn't matter, because, Errol, they are not acknowledged and not remembered. And this is what's so crazy, when all the evidence is pointing still to so much more than that. Real science fiction, real stuff, Errol.
And not only gone and forgotten, but in some cases, as Frank pointed out, denying their existence.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up, too, because that all speaks to Frank Fascino's report about the official accident reports and how they show signs of real obfuscation and cover-up. And case in point right there are two pilots that were involved in the Flatwoods Monster affair on that September night in 1952, Lieutenants John Jones and John Del Curto, who were lost that September 12th in their Starfire during this affair. They were lost in a combat action, but the Air Force in no way wanted to own up to it. There was no record. The Air Force said they did not exist. When Frank Fascino found them, they were derided. There was character assassination and all sorts of misstatements of fact and conflicting reports and imprecise reports. And Frank was able to report on his very complete and above-board examination over a freaking decade that these boards of inquiry that were set up to investigate all of this stuff were senseless inaccuracies. They were ridiculous incompetency accepted as standard operating procedure. I mean, crazy, crazy stuff. And here's the killer, the real punctuation. Missing are the September 1952 accident reports for that period, when there is evidence all the way around that month of some real crazy losses of men and machines.
That's like the Roswell Army Air Force Base records disappearing.
Exactly. I've spent a lot of time with Frank, a lot of time with him on the telephone. I've sat with him. I've listened to his story. And, man, I'll tell you what, it just gets better and better and better as time goes on. He makes discoveries that more completely complete the record. Fascinating, unbelievable stuff, killer stuff.
What blows me away about Frank is that he spent 17 and a half years researching, and almost every fact sticks in his brain. And he can quote dates, names. He's got it all there. If he were inventing any of this stuff, how could he possibly remember all of that, having been over and over and over and over the reports?
Well, that's the one thing about telling the truth. You don't have to remember so much, do you? You know, what's really crazy about Frank, he has collected such a massive amount of varied and eclectic material, well, over a decade and a half now, that provides requirement for what is a lot of money in storage fees, because he's told me that the size of storage he keeps this in is about the size of a good New York art gallery.
It's absolutely mind-blowing.
And, you know, consider, too, Errol, all the serious collections of historical artifacts that he's amassed and that he's put together. And all of these things would have been otherwise completely lost to history, but that he was around to winnow them out and keep them all together. The point is that all this information that Frank has gleaned, it was there all the time in Blue Book itself. 200-plus pages just describing the event that night as a single meteor in the air for 6 seconds. And then Frank, in his first couple of looks at the data, discovered that it was over 120 minutes of continuous sightings around that period. And it was just the look. 120 minutes, Errol, taken for a 6-second meteor, which, oh, by the way, never occurred anyway. But here's the killer. As Frank digs deeper and looks harder and uncovers more facts, he discovers that that 6-second meteor equated to just under 20 hours of continuous UFO sightings on that September night in 1952. Crazy stuff! Okay, we're talking about UFOs and the information, the evidence is going to be dodgy anyway. So maybe he had many eyewitness accounts. And that was the bulk of his evidence. That was followed by newspaper accounts, and that equated for a little bit more. And then he'd get a smattering from an official document like Blue Book. But no, it was the complete inverse of that. He got all of his information virtually for Blue Book, over 65%. And then newspaper articles, which, oddly enough, Blue Book was pointing at a lot of these things, telling him where to go look for records of sightings, and darned if he didn't find them. And then just a few eyewitness reports tacked on the end. That's another thing that is just so astonishing about this. You'd think eyewitness accounts, newspaper accounts, then Blue Book. But no, it was Blue Book first, then lots of newspaper accounts, and then just a few eyewitness accounts, you know? He's got the information, is what I'm trying to say.
And as he said, anybody's welcome to come and look at it.
Yeah, exactly.
I got it all.
Exactly. And when they look and they see 12 crash landings in two states, followed by 7 downed pilot operations where these craft weren't crash landing like some of these others were. No, they were setting up perimeters around those that had crash landed. Crash landing, exploding, forced landings, trailing flames and sparks and smoke and making little putt-putt noises and flaming, sparkling pieces flying off. Just completely nutsoid. But it's all there in the data. It's all bulletproof. He's got it nailed.
As I said to Frank, I really hope that somebody goes and looks at the evidence other than you
right.
and I or Stan Friedman.
They've certainly got every right and authorization to do so, given that respected members of their community had gone in first off and looked and showed professional interest. And I'm talking about Ivan Sanderson and Donald Kehoe. Both of these guys showed professional interest. That Frank is just not making this stuff up. Every statement is documented. Everything he says has a citation. And what's really ironic, too, is that a lot of this stuff is backed up even by Richard Hall when he writes about what was going on in 1952 in his Journal of UFO History. Like, that's some real irony there.
Guys at the Center for UFO Studies in Chicago, I hope you're listening. Go take a look.
I agree with you 100%, especially, and out of politeness, I'm sure, and we're still being pretty polite. You and Frank and Furry still a little too politely danced around the seeming fact that three generations of UFO researchers, from Donald Kehoe to Paul Kimball, for God's sakes, all the luminaries in the field since 1947 forward, all of them missed the biggest flap in United States history. And I don't think I'm putting too fine a point on that.
I think it's the biggest UFO flap in world history.
I think so. There's a lot of people writing about this and being serious about it. Billy Cox has written a couple of serious articles on it. Mannix Porterfield, the API writer and the writer for the Herald in Charleston, West Virginia. And I think it's also interesting to note, too, talking again about back in the old days, Gray Barker, of all people, wrote that this whole Flatwoods thing was a real jigsaw, and if only he had the data to put it all together. Which is to say, if only he had Blue Book back then, he could have put this stuff together. And that's why I think somebody like Dr. Condon of the infamous Condon report or the Condon study, he had Blue Book, you see. He could have been forthcoming then. And how much further ahead would we be right now?
Maybe it explains why Condon had the attitude of being very anti-UFO when he was a prof at the University of Colorado.
Exactly. But still, it remains 1951 to 1956, 204 accidents of aircraft, men and machines, destroyed, and destroyed in peculiar situations, too. 199 pilots and radar operators killed. That 204 accidents equated to 229 aircraft, because 12 of those involved multiple airplanes. And after all of this, the Air Force has no explanation. Well, Errol, I have had some military aviation experience, and I know that when you have these kind of losses, you stop flying. That's the way it works. These men and machines do not grow on trees. And losses such as this would not have been remotely tolerated, but they were doing something.
So only during wartime do you not have boards of inquiry and ground the aircraft. What we have here is aircraft that weren't grounded, and yes, they did have boards of inquiry, which Frank Fascino says were a complete disgrace when you look at the results of those boards.
Right, when you look at the senseless inaccuracies and the ridiculous explanations and incompetence accepted as standard operating procedure. Unbelievable.
So what we are looking at is, in fact, a war between the United States Air Force and whatever was buzzing the United States airspace.
I really don't think you can look at it any other way, Errol.
Mm-hmm.
I think Frank Fascino is just starting to get some wind underneath his wings on this thing, and I think people are starting to come out and have a look at what he's saying and actually reading the book before they have any criticism to make. And I've got great feelings about where Frank's headed on this thing, and I think he's going to do good things for all of us.
Amen. Hallelujah, brother.
Thank you, and good night.
Good, Alfred. Thank you, sir.
I guess we'll see you next time, Errol, and looking forward to it.
Me too. And we'll spend a little longer next time. We've got a packed program.
That's when they're great. Auf Wiedersehen, mein Herr.
Auf Wiedersehen, Alfred. That's
this edition of Strange Days Indeed. My thanks to Dave Berlot, David Cherniak, Frank Fascino, and, of course, Alfred Lemberg. My thanks for being out there and listening. We'll talk to you next time.
That's this edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli. Send any questions or comments to sdi@virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Fit Productions. Join us again for more Strange Days Indeed from the Virtually Strange Network.